Okay.
Very convicting that you're doing that. I mean, I'm looking at what a good girl you are. The water. I'm drinking this because I'm not a good girl. I haven't been drinking water.
Okay, so we are on lesson 7, which is perfect since we have 7 weeks away from the lessons. So we'll have 7 pieces of homework to do. Actually, we'll have 8 lessons and 7 pieces of homework to look over. So so we've talked about trying to describe an experience. So an experience of actually parasailing or an experience of seeing something and trying to describe what you see. And I want us to keep that mindset in the background as we look at this first Sermon on the Mount, what we normally call the Ten Commandments or the Decalogue or the Old Covenant. We have many different names for that. So,
I've never heard the Decalogue.
The Decalogue, it means the ten words. Ten.
The Decalogue.
Oh, Decalogue. That's interesting. So, we have only 2 chapters here, and literally we could do the entire semester on these 2 chapters. Mainly because I think we have to, erase all the things we've learned so much about it, it being these rules we live by. Which I hope that we've already established a lot of that in other studies, but we'll see. So, we're at the point where the Israelites have seen all these miracles. They've experienced all these miracles, and they continue to grumble. And they see these they experience these miracles, and they grumble. And they experience these miracles, and they grumble. So God at this point is saying, stop. Stop right now. Stop what you're doing. Stop moving in your own pace. Stop. I want you to rest here. I'm going to give you a point of rest, so that you will begin to have eyes to see what I'm trying to do with you. Because you are moving without concern for at all of the reality of what's going on. And I want you to be able to see with new eyes what is going on, because I'm doing a new thing here and you need to see it. So stop. So the interesting thing is they've been moving all along. It's taken them almost 2 months to get to this point, and he's going to stop them, and he's going to make them stay here for almost an entire year. So this is where the rest of Exodus takes place. It's where all of Leviticus takes place. It's where some of Numbers takes place. And Deuteronomy is kind of a review of all those. So this is a place that God is saying, you got to stop here. You've got to begin to see what's really going on. So that's where he begins this. And he begins it really with a proposal. He has a proposal for them. So we start at, where are they? Let's start with that. Where has God stopped them?
At Mount Sinai.
Right, at Mount Sinai. And Mount Sinai means thorny. Sinai means thorny. And of course, we are in a wilderness. So we're kind of in a thorny wilderness. And it's also called the Mountain of God. So what I want you to do is start thinking about these things, because what places are called and when they get there and where when they do things are all important, because they're tied in. So remember, God never says, well, this is when they got there and this is what it's called, just to give you information. It's always to tell you the story in a little deeper way. Just like if you like literature enough, you understand that good literature is written with certain literary devices to get you underneath thinking. Do you know what I mean by that? Mm-hmm. So that there are ways that writers write to kind of get you to think, even though they don't spell it out for you. This is what's happening. We do this all the time when we talk, but God specifically has written down his story with specific things, so that when he tells you this is when they got there and this is where they got, he wants you to be like, oh, there's something in here I know about, something I know about. So think about those things. I'm sorry?
Inferences.
Kind of some inferences, and they're inferences that should recall for us. Oh, Oh, what about this? Oh, and that's what we're going to start seeing. It's really how we've talked about there are layers in at people's stories. There are layers in the way we live. And that's really what he's doing is, well, here's the first layer. In the beginning of the third month, they got to Mount Sinai. There's the first layer. This is what's happening. Mm-hmm. But then there's going to be a second layer to that, and there's going to be a third layer. So that's how we're going to look at that. So, and they get there in the third month. So remember, they left Egypt at Passover. They had Passover, which was in the middle of the month, 15th of the month. And so they've traveled. That was the first month. Then they traveled 15 days in the first month. The next time they traveled a month, so 30 or 31 days, depending. And then we're now at the beginning of the third month. So we're 2.5, almost 3 months into the journey. Okay, so that, remember, a reason for us to know that. So we are about not quite 3 months into the journey. So he tells us where they're at, how long it's taken them to get there. And then he says to Moses, I want to tell you, go and tell. Interesting. I love how he says this. Then you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the sons of Israel. Are these two different groups?
No.
Why does he call them two different names then?
That was a question for me.
Yeah, well, why?
Because Israel is Jacob.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to give him a name?
Well, he's already given him a name, right? He's given him Israel. Okay. House of Jacob.
Oh, he's reminding them of where they came, where they're from.
Very good. House of Jacob is who they started out in Egypt with, and now they're the sons of Israel. Mm-hmm. So they have they've come already a long way, and the way they came was in slavery. They came from the house of Jacob to sons of Israel. So he's showing them they have always been on a journey, and he's always been bringing them on a journey. So he's continuing that. So he's beginning to give them glimpses of what he wants them to see. So then he says, first and foremost, what I want you to see, you've been on a journey, and it's been me who's carried you the whole time. It's always been by grace. So when we think about the Old Testament, we often want to categorize the Old Testament as the wrath of God or the conditional part of God. When God says, it's always been about grace. Always has. I showed you this in Abraham, and I'm going to show you this with the sons of Israel. It's always been about grace. You have been on a journey, and it's always been about me giving you grace. And so he just delineates the three things. The first thing is, remember the Egyptians? I judged them, didn't I? Could have been you, because you were in the exact same place. You were transactional just as well as they were. Could have been you. It's grace that I chose you out of that. It's grace. Remember your deliverance? You didn't do anything to be delivered. I delivered you. And he says, I delivered you as if on eagle's wings. So I'm going to give you that picture of what that looks like. And then he says, not only did I deliver you, but now I'm drawing you to myself. And I'm drawing you, is what they're going to find out, through training that you might see that you need me. So this is what it's going to be about from here on in. I'm going to train you that you might see that you need me. So here's the story of how eagles raise their young. Let's see if I can remember it all without having to read it. So a male eagle will first identify the highest place he can find on a cliff, and he will gather, he'll pick thorns and gather thorns and put them on the edge of the cliff so that no predators can get to the eggs once the female lays them. Then he'll go back and he'll keep flying over and over again, and he'll get twigs and things to make a nest. And it talks about an eagle actually layers his nest. I think all birds do, but this in particularly. He starts it with twigs. Then he puts thorns in the nest itself on top of the twigs. And then he puts soft grass on top of that so that it's soft for them. He continues to layer and layer until the very last thing that he puts on is pinions. Do you know what pinions are? But what kind of feathers?
I thought they were the wing feathers, but I would assume they'd be the down.
Yeah, the down, the underneath, the soft feathers.
He picks them off himself?
He picks them off of himself and layers them on the nest so that the baby eaglets have a place of very softness to rest. So this is how the male protects. Once the eggs are hatched, though, kind of a different story. Then the mother takes over and she begins to train. So it's interesting that the mother trains the eaglets, because really, is that not how we do it? Really, it's the mom that trains.
So the male builds the nest?
Mm-hmm. The male builds it. So the first thing she does for the eagles to train them is that she actually throws them out of the nest to see it, to learn how to fly. But they become scared, and so they jump back into the nest. She throws them out again, and she takes off the soft layers out of the nest. So that when they come back in, what's going to happen? It's real thorny, right? They're jumping into thorns. And of course, now they jump into the nest where they thought it was comfortable. And the mother knows this is not a place for you to grow up in. It's too small. It will bind you. So I will make sure that you don't stay in that nest. But of course, the baby eagles are screaming, crying. They're bloody. Like, what's going on here? And they're like, they don't like this. And the mother is letting them fall. And they don't know how to fly yet. And they're falling. And this is the picture that Scripture brings about the eagles, is what happens then is the eagle comes underneath that baby and makes sure to catch the baby so that the baby begins to fly on his wings. So the eagle lets the baby fall, flies on the wings, and then she continues to do it over and over and over again, training the baby eagle to understand that she needs the mom, or I don't know which one that does that. I think it's the mom that. No, it's the father that flies out and picks them up. So this training involves first protection, but then some pain and understanding that you can't stay in this place, this small place. You can't stay. It's not good for you. And it's going to hurt you if you do, but I'm going to have to hurt you to make sure you don't go back there. I need you to understand that this is not a good place to be, but I also need you to understand when you're falling, I'm going to be the one who's flying for you. I'm going to be the one so that you fall on top of me. So this is the picture that God gives to Israel. I've been taking care of you just like an eagle takes care of its young. And that picture there should be for them this picture of, oh, you're going to train me so that I know I need you. Of course, like us, we don't even look at that way. Oh, I'm supposed to do this. Okay, I'll do this. I'm supposed to fly, so then I better fly. And so we begin to look at it completely differently, losing that picture of what God is trying to do with them. So that's the fact that God says, it's by grace that you've gotten here, it's going to be continuing by grace that you live. I mean, doesn't Galatians say that? You know, Paul says, what are you thinking? You started out by grace and now you're going to do your life by works? Why do you think that would work? I mean, Paul kind of just says it right out there. And God is showing them, you're not going to understand this until you experience it. So I'm going to have you experience this. I'm going to put forth an experience for you that you understand this. So he puts forth this proposal. I have a proposal for you. I would like you to be this. Would you like to be this? If you do this, I'll be this. Now, sounds like a transaction, doesn't it? Boy, here we go with conditions and transaction. And basically what God's saying is, You think that you can do these things. You think that you can get what you want. You basically still are carrying the idea of you being a god out of Egypt. Well, I'm going to train you. I'm going to let you experience whether that works or not. Let's see if it works. So I'm going to give you this opportunity. Here's what I'd like you to be. This is what I'm offering you. I'm offering you a new relationship. You don't know anything about relationships because you've not lived in a relational kingdom. You've lived in a transactional kingdom. I'm going to give you the opportunity to try to have relationship through transactions. And let's see if it works. Because you need to understand that you need me. You need to understand that relationship is superior to transactions. But me telling you this is never going to work. You have to experience it. So here we go. Here's a proposal. I want to have a relationship with you, and I want to have a relationship that is very different than what you have been used to. This relationship I want is an intimate relationship. And in fact, he says, this is what I'm offering you. Would you like to be my showpiece, my treasure? It says my possession. That word there is treasure, actually. Would you like to be my treasure, my showpiece, the thing that shows people how rich I am, how sovereign I am over everything? Would you like to be that? Would you like to be my kingdom of priests, the people that mediate for me all of my grace? Would you like to be that? This is this opportunity to have a relationship with me that's so intimate that you get to show the world what I'm like. You get to be my priest, my treasure, my holy nation. You get to manifest my character. Would you like to be that? So that's the proposal. And really, it's a proposal, it's almost a marriage proposal. And some people have said that the Ten Commandments here, the Mount Sinai passage here, is really this marriage proposal. Of us, of God saying, I want to have that intimate relationship with you. This is what I want, and this is what I want it to look like. In other words, I want you to be my body that shows the world what I'm like. You and I become one so that when people see you, they see me. That's the relationship he's offering. It's the relationship he's always been offering. It's the relationship he continues to offer. But he's telling them, this is what I'm offering you. Would you like to do it? You want to try it your way? Okay, let's see. Let's see if we can, if you can be my body by doing these things. Let's see if you can do that. So, he offers this, but then he says, but in order to approach me, you're going to have to do some things my way here. So you're going to have to approach and enter into this engagement first in my way. You're going to have to come this way. First, it's going to have to, he gives them an invitation of choice, right? He doesn't say you must. He says, here's an invitation. Would you like this? If you do this, you can have this. Would you like that? Yes. And it has to be by assent. You have to agree to the conditions. So this is conditional. If you do this, you can be this. So you have to agree to the conditions. You have to come, actually, before you even come into my presence, you're going to have to do some things. And what are the three things that he asks them to do?
Consecrate themselves
and wash. Those are two of the same, basically. Consecrate says, don't go near anything that defiles you. And wash, the word wash here is not to wash the body, it's to beat the clothes. So it's to beat the dirt out of you. I'm sorry, right? So respect the boundaries. And there's one other thing. Yeah, but how did sex is consecrate. Keep yourself away from things that defile. What's the... What?
It was coming in 3 days.
So, but what are the words? I love the words here. Be ready for the third day. And really, if any of you read that and just skipped over it and then go, be ready for the third day? Oh, remember, God is... choosing specific words so that we remember and that things are coming out. Oh, remember, be ready for the third day. Be ready for the third day. Interesting if you start looking through scripture about the third day. Very, very interesting. So be ready for the third day. But what that does is, that also is going to, let's do our little math here, if they have come to Mount Sinai at around the 47th day, 46, 47, what day are we at now when God is going to come to them? So we're around 50. We're at 50 days past Passover. Okay.
That's
so
that's Pentecost.
Yeah. So we have this time frame, and we have how they're going to come, and then we also want, God says, I want you to be afraid. I want you to keep your distance. So he puts these boundaries and says, don't even come near. Don't even touch the mountain. Interesting, isn't it, that he's giving them a proposal to have a relationship, and then he says, don't touch. Don't even come near me at all. Which is, I just thought about this, but
engagement.
Yeah, the engagement is don't touch. I want this close relationship with you, don't touch. And if they touch, what happens?
They die.
They die, that's right. So it's like, he's serious about this, right? Don't touch, otherwise you die. And then as he comes to them, describe how he comes to them.
Thunderous.
Okay, so we have thunder, dark clouds, lightning, trumpets, earth shaking, and fire. Fire and smoke, big thing. So we have this, wow, all of these phenomena going on. And so the interesting thing is we don't know which is God. Is he the fire? Is he the smoke? Is he the thunder? Is he all of it? And he's saying to them, experience the fact that I am not something you can pin down. I am not the fire. I am not the thunder. I am all of it at different times and in different ways. And every part of me is powerful and big and formless. And this is important, very important, as we understand what he's calling them, what kind of a relationship he's calling them to. When we know that someone is formless, what do we call it?
Mysterious
spirit. Mm-hmm. So really what he's defining for them is, I'm spirit. I have no form. You can't pin me down. I'm spirit. Understand that. And of course, when we think about this, I mean, let me tell you this. There will be so many times I'll just go, oh yeah, that. Because there's so many things that we think about. When Jesus comes to the woman of Samaria, what does she talk about? You go to this mountain to worship. We go to this mountain to worship. And he says, there will come a time when it won't be about a mountain, but you all worship what? In spirit. And so here, all the way at the very beginning, God is saying, I'm spirit. You need to understand I'm spirit. I am not something that you can contain and put in a form. I'm spirit. I'm alive. Very different from what they know of the gods in Egypt. In many, many ways. And we'll kind of go under that a little bit more. So he's given them an invitation. He's given them a way to approach him, but not too close. And now, so we've gone through all of 19, and now he's going to give them the living arrangements. Okay, so this relationship that I have, here's the living arrangements. This is what it's going to look like in this relationship. You have not known a relationship like this because you've been in a transactional world, so you don't know this. In fact, your living arrangement in Egypt was so not like this. You viewed gods and other people as slaves. You were not viewed as human beings. You were viewed as a tool to be used, right? That's how they know that. They've experienced what it's like to be viewed as a tool to be used. And this is really important for them to know, because also in Egypt world, in the kingdom of Egypt, it's how they viewed gods too. Gods were only tools to be manipulated so they got what they wanted. So if they appeased the god of fertility, they would have the babies they wanted. If they would appease the gods of the harvest, their crops would grow well. So they viewed gods as transactional. And so in a transactional world, we view others and gods as tools to get what we want. That's what transaction is all about. I make a transaction with you because I know I can get something from you that I want. And so I will view you as a tool to get what I want. And that's the world they lived in. In fact, Egypt was just a representation of how all the world had been working for a long time. Is each person away from relationship and more toward getting life for themselves? That's what they've known. And so now he's saying, I'm going to show you what the kingdom looks like, the relational kingdom looks like, what it's like to actually have relationship with people and that be the value rather than transactions be the value. And I think sometimes for us, we say, yeah, I get that. But because we so live in a transactional world, it's very difficult for us to separate those and understand. And so God, for them, this is the exact same thing. This is all they've known, is transactional world. They don't get it. They've already seen his transformational relationship over and over again with their delivery, with their going through the Red Sea, with the Egyptians being killed, with the bitter water turning to sweet water, with the water coming out of the rock, with the manna. They've seen this relational love, and they don't get it because they're still viewing it as a transaction. So he's saying, yeah, stop. Let's see what you think, what it looks like if it's transactional. Let's see if it works. Let's see. So he's saying, here's the living arrangements. This is what it's going to look like in a kingdom that's relational. It's going to look like, first and foremost, always the basis is grace. It's always going to be about grace in relationships. Interesting. If we actually enter into relationships knowing that it's going to be founded on grace, looks completely different, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. How do we usually enter relationships? In some level, we understand there's going to be some transactions. Like. Yeah. And so we might begin being, just giving, but pretty soon we're going to have this resentment like, well, I'm giving and giving and I'm not getting, right? And where does that come from? That comes from a basis of transaction. And God's saying, my kingdom doesn't look like that at all. My kingdom is based on grace. It's all about giving where it's undeserved. So this is what kind of relationship he's talking about is going to be his kingdom. So what he's doing is giving them a picture of what he's bringing them to, why he's redeemed them, to bring them to a life of relationship rather than a life of transaction. So he says there's going to be two ways that we're going to do this. We're going to have a relationship that respects one another because it gives grace and it's about grace. And you're going to learn how to respect a relationship with me. Now, here, this is so new to them. Has there ever been a time when they've been able to relate to the gods? No, the gods don't relate. They have nothing to do with relationship. They're only about, I'll give you this, you give me that. That's all they are. They've never had that. And now God's saying, here, I'm going to ask you to be into a relationship where actually you and I have this relationship that's really intimate. In fact, so intimate that we become as one. This is the kind of relationship I want. This is a grace relationship where you absolutely complete me. We say that in today's terms, and I always go, oh, no, there's not a human being that does complete me, but God does. And that's the relationship that he's calling them into. So it's going to be a relationship of respect, you between me and God, God and you. There's also going to be a respectful relationship between one another. And here's what it's going to look like. And so he puts forth what we call the Ten Commandments. Right here, he's not putting it forth as commandments so much as, here's the covenant I'm making with you. Here's the agreement. Here's the marriage agreement I'm making with you, that this is what marriage is going to look like. This is what my relationship with you is going to look like. It's going to look like you relating to me in a respectful, grace-filled way. And it's also going to do that with other people. So, kind of looking at the Ten Commandments in a completely different way as a picture of what he's calling us into, what the kingdom actually looks like, how we actually value relationship, grace relationship. So, yeah.
Weren't the Ten Commandments part of what people called the law? I mean, besides all the 430, all those other things.
Yeah, definitely was the law.
Okay. So, like, in the New Testament, we're informed that the law is supposed to show us death, right? So, like, how do those work in light of what you're saying?
Okay. Let's go through that and then see at the end what God is doing here. This is definitely, he is right now saying, this is a picture of what marriage is going to look like with me. This is a picture of what it's going to look like with me. I'm going to give you a chance to try to do it. I'm going to give you this chance to try to do it. When you finally realize that you need me, then it's going to look completely different. Mm-hmm. But it's still, marriage is still going to look like this with me. It is going to look like this. But it's not going to be you doing it. So he has to give them the chance to understand that they can't do this. So he's going to give them this. At this point, interesting, if you were to read this in Hebrew, this actually would not be called the law or the Decalogue. This would be called the covenant here. It's not until Deuteronomy that it's called the law, the way it's written in Hebrew. So he's not even saying this is the law here. Right now he's saying this is an agreement here for you and I to enter into to make a relationship. Let's see if we can do it. Let's see if this works. And then later he'll bring it in as the law.
Okay, now I'm just, this is what someone would ask me. Why is God making it so hard?
What did we say at the very beginning?
Right,
but this is,
why does it have to be so
and this
hard?
Is here. This,
I don't know until you experience it.
It's, you don't know until you experience it. Parasailing. And people will tell you, I remember people explain to me parasailing. Okay, now it's really fun and you'll have this, but at first it's kind of hard because you can't try to steer it and you can't try to do this. And at first it's really hard, but all of a sudden you are able to do this and you let go. Oh, but you'll never understand that unless I have you experience it. And yet, at the beginning, you're going to be afraid. It's going to be kind of scary. If you don't like water, it's going to be scary. So why does he make it hard? He doesn't make it hard. He gives you the opportunity to experience it so that you actually know it rather than, which is what we do to it. So, and that's part of kind of the beginning of the answer to your question as well, is I need you to experience that relationship never comes out of transaction. Every time you try to do relationship with transaction, it falls apart, doesn't it? It falls apart. So
this is kind of setting you up like a transaction.
Yes.
Right?
He's purposely doing that. I'm setting up a transaction for you because this is how you are going to experience that transactions don't work.
Right. So this is how you relate to a perfect God.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Right.
So
this,
how is that a picture of the grace relationship?
We'll see that
in
a while. Okay. So,
the points are
needed, basically. Yes, exactly.
You know what I mean?
All right. And it's sometimes hard to teach this because we know so much on the grace side, but we know so much on the grace side that we don't understand the law side, and we need to understand both and why he's doing this. So let's go through what we call the Ten Commandments and see what's going on here. Remembering that this is how marriage with him will look. It will look like respectful relationship. He's saying, can you do it by transactional work? Can you? I'll give you the experience. Let's see if you can. Do we ever do this with our children? You want to do this on your own? Okay, fine. I'll let you try to do this on your own when you know perfectly well they can't. But they need to go through that. And when we don't give them those experiences, what happens is, and I've seen this happen a lot, when we're such a hovering parent and we don't let them fail, they'll fail down the road where they don't have any security. And what's God doing? He's letting them fail in the middle of the wilderness where they're not going to affect anybody else, where it's just them. He's giving them this safe environment to fail and to come to the point where they understand they've got to be connected with Him or it's not going to work.
So this further informs our marriage vows.
Absolutely.
Insofar as they're really not meant to be a standard that we can keep
right.
for perfection.
Right, right.
But something that we need God.
Right. We absolutely need God to be able to do this, to be able to be in a relationship of grace rather than a transactional relationship. Because that's all we know, except by experience with God. So, first one, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. That's what he starts with. Interesting that he starts this. Why? Notice that I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, is how he reminds them of grace. So that every time he uses the phrase, I am the Lord your God, it should go back to, I'm the one who brought you grace. I've brought you here because not because you deserved it, but because I'm giving you a good gift. This is grace. This is grace. This is grace. It's all based on grace. And you'll notice him saying that over and over and again. I am the Lord your God. I'm the Lord your God. In fact, in the first five books of the Bible, you will see that as the key word. I am the Lord your God. I'm the Lord your God. And often, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of slavery. This is important for them to understand that it is grace that's going to get us through here, not our efforts. So he's giving them inklings. He's helping them to see little by little. So the first commandment. What's the first commandment? Okay, you shall have no other gods before me. Okay, this relationship is going to be a two become one kind of thing. No other lovers come into this play. It's just you and me. We're completely dependent on one another. And in fact, he is willing to be dependent on us. And we've talked about this before, and it sounds so weird. God dependent on us. What's he dependent on us for? What was the... To what?
Relationship with
him. Yeah, relationship. To be, at the very beginning, he said, I'd like you to be, would you like to be my priests? My body? You want to be my body? I'm going to depend on you for being my body. And you're going to depend on me for everything, for life. So it's going to be this mutually grace-filled relationship of just you and me, no one else.
But it all starts out with honoring God. The baseline is you honor God.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what he's talking here is honor my relationship here with you. Honor this relationship that we are one. It's got to start with that. Because if we fail to receive that relationship of us being one, we are always going to be have this desire to be outside of that oneness. Oh, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. Instead of we together, God is going to do it with me, in me.
I kept thinking of that phrase, God is my all in all. Mm-hmm. That's what kept coming
yes.
to my mind
yes.
when I was doing this lesson. You
yeah.
know?
Exactly, exactly. And so, of course, even in our living today, if we are living like that and receiving that, because if it's grace, we're receiving it, we're not doing it. If we're receiving that, then our relationship with others is very different because we're not looking for them to get what we need. Mm-hmm. I mean, that makes every difference in the world. I can't live a grace relationship with you if I'm not living as one with God, because I will still need something. And boy, you're the closest thing to give me what I need. So you're going to give me affirmation. You're going to give me whatever. By the way, who gave me those beautiful roses and the silver things? Who brought those?
Yeah, that was on my table.
Those are gorgeous. Ah, beautiful. So anyway, this is key that it starts here, that you become one with him. And of course, as they're laid out as a condition, you do this. You hold on to me only. And I mean, we sit here and go, there is no way I can do it. I know I can't do it. But let me try it. Let's try and see if I can. I mean, how many times has someone said you can't do this? And what is that, especially for some of us? As soon as they say that, what do? I am going to prove you can do it. Yeah. In fact, to my shame, it is often how I get Bill to do things. Oh, I don't think you can do that. Oh, what? What did you say? I remember standing out in front of the door, and we used to have an ugly silver maple out there, and I looked and I said, that tree really needs to come down. And he goes, and I said, but you know what? Pick up for the branches is tomorrow. There's no way we're going to be able to get that down today. We got it down today. He was out within 10 minutes. He's out there chopping this whole big tree down. That's our nature. So God says, you want to try this? Oh, yeah, I want to try this. I can do this. No, you can't, but I'll let you try so that you know. So you have no other God. Second commandment.
Which is why Jesus was kind of like, and the guy was like, I've done all those.
Uh-huh, yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no problem. Second commandment. What's the second commandment?
No graven images or idols.
You shall not make for yourself an idol. Now, this is not the same as verse 1. We need to understand this. So you shall have no other gods before me. You shall have no one, nothing in your life that you get life from, that you don't come to me for. This is, and I think we don't realize this, when he says you shall not make any idols or graven images of me, it's of him, he says. You are to make nothing of form that you worship as me. Why? He's already set them up for this.
He's spirit.
Because he's spirit. He's not form. He's spirit. And if I confine him to a static form, then I will miss him when he comes as something else. Mm-hmm. This is so important. This is not about idols. This is about making an image of him in our head or in our actions. Mm-hmm. We are not to make a form of him, because when he comes in a different way, we won't see him. And here's the most interesting thing about that. What does he want him to look like to us? What has he already asked? Do you want to be my priest?
Yes.
Do you want to be my body?
If
we're his image, which he's already told us, and I've made a static image of him looking this way, then when you come into my life and you speak to me and you bring me grace, I don't see God. We hold his image. He says, I want you to be in this relationship with me so that in your life, people see me. And if you've made me as an image, God is this way, you won't see God anywhere else. And you won't see God in people. And therefore, you can grumble about people. And therefore, you can push people away. And therefore, relationships aren't that important. Yeah. Now, do you understand that relationship with people is all about relationship with God? So this make no images is all about him. It's not about the idols. You understand? They're two separate, completely separate things. And I hear a lot of people saying, well, they're the same thing. And they're not even close. Does that make sense? You get what he's asking here? The other thing he talks about in this, and we are not going to, we could spend hours and hours on these. We're not going to go deep into all of them. But he does talk about if we do this, that he will visit the iniquity of the fathers on the children on the third and fourth generations. Here's what he's talking about here. He's saying, if you, in your mind, have an image of me, you will pass it down to your children, because it will be an attitude of what I'm like. This is what God is like, and he's only like this. And you'll pass that attitude down to your children. So, here's the scary thing. If I have an image of God as being transactional, I pass that down without any verbal cues whatsoever. I pass that down in the way I live, because I live as if he's transactional, I will pass that attitude down. And it will be passed down to the third and the fourth generations. So that they will take that attitude and have him in a static image. Now, that's a lot more serious. And we understand that. So this is why he's saying, man, having in your head an image of what I'm like is dangerous. I want to be able to come to you in all sorts of ways. And remember, what did we learn about the Sermon on the Mount? The kingdom of God is unlikely. It's the most unlikely thing that will come to you. And if you have this static image of what God is like, you will never see him. You will never experience him. And that's what's happening to them is they have a static image. That's all they know is static images of gods. And they've brought that with them. In fact, we're going to find out in the next couple chapters, they literally have carried images with them. Yeah. And they say, and what do they say about the golden calf that they eventually make? Well, this is you. This is you, God. This is the static image. And we laugh and go, how can they say a cow is God? But this is what God is saying. Yes, any static image that you have of me is a golden calf. So this is a very important understanding that we come to, that in the way that the kingdom works is we allow the spirit to work as a spirit and not as a form.
You know what's really crazy about this is, like, having been in Turkey and seeing these churches that were like 300-400 AD, like, as soon as the persecution died off, right, as soon as Christians had some level of stability and security, they're like, oh, let's make images.
Yes. Yes.
And so there's all these churches with images.
Yep.
It's just interesting.
Yep. Yep. Comes
that's
over
so
and over
awesome.
Again.
You know, when you think about it, once we get comfortable,
yeah,
our car can be our image.
Right.
Our
right. 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 Really, for us here, success is an image of God. God has brought me blessing and success. That's what God is like.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of when we're going through the really hard times saying, God is in this and he's bringing me grace. This is grace here. This hard thing, this is grace. Because, I mean, how many of us hold up that image of God? We don't. And God says, I don't want you to hold up any image of me. I want you to allow me to work in all sorts of ways, in thunder, in lightning. And this is why he brings to them these visuals. But it's not just visuals. Understand that how he came to them was in every single way touching every sense. So I can come to you to touch any one of your senses. They've already tasted him in the manna. And now they see, they hear, they smell. All of these things. It says God is not able to be pinned to a static image. So, commandment 3. What is that?
And he can't be manipulated.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, you shall not take the name of the Lord in vain. If we are his priests, if these Israelites are called to be his priests, that means they carry around his name. If they carry it in a way that is ordinary, that is without thought, if they carry his name in any way, if they act as if he is not I am, that he's not present, then they devalue his name. Let's think of it this way. If you are in a room and I want to tell you something about, I want to tell you something about Sherilyn. And I just say, can you believe what Sherilyn did? And she's sitting right there. Would I do that? Mm-hmm. No. But maybe I would do it if Sherilyn went outside for a call. And then I'd say, when I talk like that, or when I just say, oh, it doesn't matter. Sherilyn doesn't care what I say about her. That's taking God's name. You know, he doesn't care. He's not here anyway. It doesn't matter what I say. Saying he is not I am. He is not who he says he is. He's not all that important. He doesn't carry a lot of weight with it. You know, it's just not important what I say about him. Or that I treat him as if he's not a big deal. They just saw that he's a big deal. They experienced it. They've been experiencing it all along. And for them ever to say, well, it's not a big deal. And how do we take God's name in vain and say God's not a big deal? How do we actually do that today?
I think just by trying to provide for ourselves and protect ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. How do we do it in words?
OMG.
Yes.
Oh.
Yes. All the time. And it is constant. We say his name without ever giving it any weight. It's just a mild exclamation. Mm-hmm. Right?
And even worse yet, the big JC.
Exactly. Exactly. So you hear this constantly, or we use it. Or, I mean, we can go all the way down the line. But here, it's the underlying behind it. Does he carry weight with you?
Well, there's a song now called that, OMG. Like, oh my. There's actually a song.
Really?
Yeah. And the whole song is him saying, oh my God. But it's about a girl.
Yeah.
And it's about essentially like a girl's, like, physique. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, not only have we taken, like,
we're
now appropriating it to a woman. Do you know what I mean? And to her physical self.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yep.
You've taken
yep.
an idol. You've made an idol.
Mm-hmm.
And you've taken this.
Right.
Let's go for all 10.
That's right.
Shoot them up.
There's two things here. What we're getting at is the underlying underneath of how important is God? Is he right here with you? Do you really believe he's I am? Because if you believe he is I am, you don't use his name as if he isn't I am. As if he isn't here. As if he's just a throwaway. But it's not just in the words, like Robin said. It's in our actions. If I'm providing for myself, he's not the I am. So it goes much deeper than just our words. Because as we've noticed with God, God's words come out in his actions, as do ours.
Even worrying.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Worrying.
Oh.
So.
Well, and it's even just like the swearing at, you know, on the Bible. Like, it's just our ways of trying to, like, control each other
yes.
with God's name.
Yes, exactly.
Like, I
exactly.
can't control whether you're not going to tell me the truth. So I'm going to use God
right.
to control whether you tell me
right,
the truth.
Exactly.
Or someone says, I swear to God.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes, exactly. And man, you get into Judges and you see what happens when you swear to God.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you end up having to kill your child.
Mm-hmm.
That happens in Judges. So. The seriousness of who God is, the weight of who God is to you in this relationship. If you think of him as your husband, you don't say things about, I mean, I hope we don't say things about our husband, but certainly we don't say things about our husband when he's right there. Because, oh my goodness, he's right there. But God is always right there. And if I don't believe that, it's easy to use his name in vain.
The other thing that's coming to me, I don't know how to even express this, but the word is reputation.
Mm-hmm.
His reputation.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I think sometimes takes his name in vain when it doesn't hurt us personally that he's not being represented well in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just have this deep sorrow in my heart that we're not representing him. I'm not representing him where people feel like they're invited
right.
to know him.
Right, exactly.
His reputation is being maligned.
Yes,
so
yes.
Not acting like the priest.
Right, exactly. Which is all, that's exactly what a priest is. Is putting out God's reputation, is showing who he really is. And that's what this is what this relationship is all about. And it is what we're called to with our husbands as well. And that is why there is so many concerns about. Interesting. The devotion I've done for the last couple times at the wedding showers I've done, I've always done this devotion. When God talks to a husband and wife, he says, wives, husbands, love your wives. What does he say to wives?
Respect.
Respect. He doesn't say love. He says respect. Because that's love mm-hmm. to a male. Mm-hmm. That's how he feels love. Mm-hmm. That's what God's saying here. Mm-hmm. Show you love me by respecting me in the way that you carry my name around, in the way that you present who I am.
But it's not just because, like, I get into the whole thing of representing, like, I feel like my kids, right, and the way I'm parenting them, it's not representing God, right? So I feel like all this, like, guilt in the way that they look, and I'm not presenting them well. But, like, I think, I don't know, like, the whole thing about respect, it's because he's there.
Right.
So it's not like I have to represent him. I'm going to fail representing him.
Right. Absolutely.
Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
But like if I just have this consciousness of God is with me.
Yes, that's exactly
it. And I'm respecting him in the way I'm disciplining them. So no matter what they look like to everybody else.
Right, exactly.
Like
yep. He's
here.
Yep.
And I respect his name not because we have a transaction where I should respect him.
Right.
But because he's like with me.
Right.
Goes back to number
right.
one and us
exactly.
with him.
Exactly.
Right.
So it's always about being, and that's what he's getting to is, look, to have a relationship like this, it's just about you being with me. Mm-hmm. It's just about letting me be with you. That's all it's about. And so if I am resting in being with him, it looks completely differently than I'm striving to show what he's like. It's resting, being with him, and then it's like everyone sees, wow, that God is pretty powerful that she can rest no matter what goes on.
And you're going to speak well about someone you think is there.
Of course. Of course, yes. So it is going back to his name is I am. I'm always here, and I'm always working out covenant, and I'm always giving grace. If that's who he is, and he's right there, then how I present his name is completely different. I can rest in, oh, he's right here. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we have those first three. And the fourth one is remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Do no work in it. And, of course, this is one that we could, and actually we will go through this a little bit more later. So we won't get deep into this. But it does bring to mind, first of all, that God is the creator, that he's the one who brings life. We've talked about this over and over again. He alone brings life. We have seen this in Egypt, that nothing can bring life. My work can't bring life. So in other words, when he says, remember the Sabbath, it's first and foremost, I'm the creator, and you are no longer slaves. You don't have to work to have worth. Rest in me, because your worth comes from me being your deliverer. Your worth comes from me being someone who says, I want to have an intimate relationship with you. You are no longer evaluated by how many bricks you made in Egypt. If we just thought about that, I am not evaluated by how often my house is clean. I am not evaluated by how I have presented my children. I'm not evaluated by that. That's not where I get my worth. I'm not worthy if my kids behave badly. I'm not worthy if I completely have a trashed house every day. I'm not worthy? No. God says, you're worthy. I've already said you're worthy by delivering you.
Jill,
yeah.
I've been reading Ezekiel the last few days here in my devotions, and I came across two verses that she should have in here. Ezekiel 20:12 and Ezekiel 20:20. And in both of those verses, it says that God gave us the Sabbath to remember his covenant with us. Mm-hmm. It's a symbol to remind us that God sanctified us. We are his people and he is our God.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's a much deeper meaning
yep.
than we think about when we just
yep.
think about
exactly.
not doing anything on Sabbath.
And what's the covenant? Is I will be your God. I will be the one who gives you life. Remember that. So if we don't have a Sabbath, we aren't remembering that he delivered us, that he gives us life. we are still living, if we're not observing a Sabbath, we're still living in a transactional world. And what he is doing again is giving them the option and the experience. You want to live in a transactional world? It doesn't work. You can choose to live in the transactional world. I have a relational world to live in. I have a transformational world for you to live in, this kingdom. And even today, we can choose to live in that relational kingdom where we rest and are just with him. Or we can go back and forth, which is really what we do most of the time, right? Ah, that transactional kingdom feels comfortable, just like the nest for the eagles. That feels comfortable, but it's binding. It keeps you in a place that you can't grow and live. If an eagle stayed in that nest, he would not live. But it's comfortable. I know what it's like there. I don't want to get out. Or sore or hurt. These first four, and I think we all know, the first four are our relationship with God, and the last are our relationship with others. These all, every one of these, emphasize the value of relationship over transaction. All of them do. It's, here's a new way of living, as opposed to the old way of living, the living that you understood in Egypt. And always remember this.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That Egypt is just a picture of how all the world was and of how all the world is. It's not a specific place, and it's not only one place. But it's all. Okay. If we go from there to the last.
Okay, so with you shall not murder, I'm sorry. You know, this is unlearning, right?
Yes, it's all unlearning.
Like, how does this fit with the kind of transactional law he put into place about, you know what I mean? Like, an eye for an eye, just like all these different things he set up.
That's so interesting. Because we live transactionally, we look at everything God does as transactional, and it's not. That eye for an eye, I'll just give you that example. It's not a transaction. It is a, somebody was plucking out somebody's eye, and the person was going, fine, I'm going to kill you. That was a, let's pull back here. You're going way beyond. You're going, I'm going to wreak vengeance on you. And so that was a, let's start pulling back. It's, let's start with just an eye for an eye. So that right there was a pulling back of what they were doing.
Okay.
So, and that's why we have to be really careful. We take things out and we go, well, God said an eye for an eye. Yeah, let's understand what's going on.
Right.
So what God does not work in transaction, and he's going, every time we think it's a transaction, it's either not a transaction or it's him training us that transactions don't work.
Okay.
Sorry, what did you say? Just the eye for eye is him showing us by experience.
No, eye for eye, what was happening during at that time, someone was, I came and plucked out your eye.
Uh-huh.
And so you were going, you plucked out my eye? Fine, I'm going to chop your head off.
Oh.
So he was, it had gone so beyond an equal transaction, okay. It was now vengeance. And he was going, okay. Let's pull back. Because if he went from that to nothing, it was too hard. So they pull him back. So that's what that is. Same thing with divorce when Moses, it's pulling back what you were doing because they were so far beyond that. Okay, so our relationship with others, respectful relationship with others. And here's the thing. All of these mirror exactly what we just learned about relationship with God. They all mirror it. So when we look at them, I don't even like to count them because we have four in under God, which looks like then we have six under us, and that's not true. So I'll kind of show you the way that it actually mirrors the exact same thing. So, Carol, you said it. At the very beginning, it all has to do with honoring God. Well, exactly. It's exactly how it starts. Honor your father and mother. Why your father and mother? Because they're the authority that God has not just placed, but chosen specifically for you.
But they're the creators of you, too.
And they are the creators. They're who for you. So they are a picture of God. They are your training ground for what it means to be under authority. And they are exclusive. You don't have a set of parents, but let your next door neighbor tell you what to do. Right? In fact, when that happens, what does Mama Bear do? How dare you tell my child what to do, right? Because this is an exclusive relationship here, that they're the one who trains. Remembering that if God not only ordained them to have authority over you, he also chose those specific people with those specific flaws to be your parents. And, you know, when I first heard that, I went, yes. Not because of the flaws my parents had, but because of the flaws I have. Because I went, oh, wow, that makes me feel a little better about the mistakes I have made in parenting. Because God actually chose the flaws I have for my child as well. And of course, he's calling me to let him fix those flaws in a very vulnerable and open way so that my child sees that as well. So, honor your father and mother. Hand in hand with you shall have no other gods. Does that make sense? Same thing, same respect, same intimate relationship, exclusive relationship of authority.
I just heard this past weekend that a child from 0 to 6, and actually as adults too, we don't really know what we look like. We actually see our reflection mm-hmm. in how people look at us.
Right.
So as children, that's their first visual of who God is. They look at, they see your their reflection looking at you.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of pulled some things together for me.
Yeah, yep.
That's how kids learn, but we can learn too as we look into his face mm-hmm. and how he looks at us. He's not
right.
He's not withdrawn, he's not
right.
unhappy, he's delighted
right.
over
right.
us. So to have
right.
that picture of him holding us like a loving father or mother,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of freeing.
Yep, that is. That's very freeing. The second one under relationships with... Oh, by the way, if I don't honor my father and mother, their honor does not... my respect for them does not come out of their own merit.
Right.
Right?
Out of their position.
Out of their position, out of them being chosen by God. So... if I do not honor, if I do not respect my parents, what I'm saying is, hey, God, you didn't do a great job here.
Well,
right?
Judgment, and then you get that
right.
judgment back.
Right, exactly. Second one, you shall not murder. The word murder here means to kill with intention and forethought.
Premeditated, we call it.
Right, premeditated. So this does not include war. This does not include
accidents,
and this does not include the government bringing in a punishment. So murder is basically, I don't like what you did, and I'm going to kill you.
Is it Raka? Same word?
Raka is fool.
Okay.
So if I take the life of an image bearer of God, I am diminishing God, and I take away somebody's opportunity to see God from that person.
Oh,
right. And I take away the opportunity for that person to be able to carry God's name, whenever that might be. So murdering is not just about taking a physical life. But because in Eden, we separate the physical and the spiritual, we don't think about that. And God says, no, the thing together, their spirit, when you kill them, you kill that opportunity for me to be seen in that person. And you kill the opportunity for that person to be able to carry my image. So it's about me. So relationship with people is always about relationship with God. And when I make an image of God in my head, or whatever, and I have this static image, what I'm doing is killing the reality of God, right? Because that's not really who he is. I'm killing everything else about God.
Mm-hmm.
So they're the same. The third commandment under relationship with other people is you shall not commit adultery. Marriage is that you are carrying around the other's name and identity, right? Mm-hmm. So when I commit adultery, what's happening there? What's happening to the reputation of the other? They're not important, right? I'm carrying around their name in me, and I'm saying, yeah, they're not really here. It doesn't matter. Just like when I take God's name in vain. They're the exact same thing.
And when you have an idol before God,
yep. Yep. Interesting that this law was actually, the point of this law was actually to protect the husband's name. Because it would protect the husband's name because you would know for sure that all the children were his. Mm-hmm. And therefore all the heirs belong to him. So it gets even deeper and deeper as we look into it. And of course you're diminishing the importance of that person that you are in covenant with as well. Fourth one. And I say fourth, even though there are three here left, because they're basically all the same thing. Now, it seems that how in the world can we equate them with remembering the Sabbath? Well, they are, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. What are we trying to do if we do any of those?
Provide
for myself. Right, I'm trying to get life for myself. And what's the Sabbath about? God is the provider, you are not. So all three of these equate with the Sabbath. So let's look really quickly into those. You shall not steal. Interesting, this actually referred to not just stealing material goods, it referred to stealing people, so kidnapping. It also referred to stealing the intangibles, such as dignity, self-respect, freedom, all of that came under do not steal.
Where do you get that from?
When you do background stuff on the culture of the time.
Okay.
Yeah. You shall not bear false witness. And this is character assassination of any kind. This is saying your neighbor is not who he says he is. I think he's a liar. I think he's a cheat. Any of that. So it's not just lying about a situation. It's assassinating their character.
But that's not honoring.
No, of course it's not. And that's what he's saying.
Boil it all down to
Here's the thing. We always look at these are things you don't do. But if we look at them as this is how God says relationships work well, and then you put yourself on the other side, not me doing that or not doing that, but somebody doing it to me or not doing it to me, it completely changes, right? Mm-hmm. I would love it if Carol doesn't steal from me. I would love it if Carol never assassinates my character. That I want that, don't I? Mm-hmm. That's how relationships work. So these look completely differently when you stand on the other side of them. Oh, yeah, I want that. I want that. I want that. I want all these things. This is the kind of relationships I want. I long for that, in fact. I long for people to respect me in such a way that they are always relating to me with grace. Is there anyone who doesn't want that? And that's what God is saying. This is how my kingdom actually works, that we actually relate to one another with grace. And in fact, it's why so many times we boil it down to the golden rule, right? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Mm-hmm. That's what this is doing. Mm-hmm. That's what the kingdom looks like. Now try to do it. And of course, we are so transactional that we...
Okay. But then I'm just thinking, God doesn't do any of these things to us.
Right.
So he doesn't steal. He
right.
doesn't murder.
Right.
He doesn't... So if we reflect on that character, right. we become that.
Right. Right. As we enter into that. But again... We cannot do it. And this is what the Israelites are going to learn for the next 40 years.
It gives Ephesians 4.
Which is?
The last part about let no one wholesome speech and mm-hmm. do not murder.
Holy cow. Yeah.
You really read that.
Yep. Yep.
That's ridiculous.
Yep. Yeah. And again, because we're transactional, we look at it as a transaction. Don't do this. Mm-hmm. Don't let any unwholesome word in my mouth. Okay. Mm-hmm. I better not talk. But it's respect, one another. Give them grace. Give them love. And remember, grace is the word charis, which we often translate as love. Give them this relationship. So it's not a don't do so much as relate. Relate with them. But again, even that, we just can't do.
If we're
just
abiding with Christ, then His Spirit can.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, and you shall not covet, I think, is pretty, I mean, he goes through that pretty well. You're not to desire what somebody else has, because if you desire what somebody else has, that means you want to take it away from them. Because in a transactional world, there's only a finite amount of stuff. And if she has this, if she just got, if she just won the Glancer Award of $50 to Sullivan Steakhouse,
I
didn't get it, and I wanted it, and so all of a sudden there's this barrier between, you know, like she didn't get it and I didn't get it and she did. In a transformational world, there's an infinite abundance of stuff. So there's this transactional, well, if she got it, I didn't. Does that make sense? Yes? No?
Well, it's also this concept that life has to look the same for all of us.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So
right.
I must not be getting life if she got
it. Right, exactly. Exactly.
Because I don't trust
what God
thinks life does for me.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yep.
It's suffering.
Right.
People,
yep.
Wow. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I do God.
Right. Well, see, again, yeah. And as soon as you say that, right. And which is what we do, oh, this happened to me. I remember doing this study was really tough for me. It took ever and ever and ever. And, you know, in the midst of it, I sinned. And I kept on arguing with God, like, oh, now I know you're not going to let me finish the study. Oh, I'm sorry. No, I know that's not how you work. You know, and this conversation, I know you don't work that way. But I did do something bad. But back and forth, like moving from the transactional kingdom to the relational kingdom. Oh. Why? Oh, the Ten Commandments over again. We could do that. And it is important for us to understand. He's giving them an opportunity to try them out. Go ahead and try them out. And he gives everybody, actually, the opportunity to try them out. Try to live transactionally and be relational and have it work like this.
Sure. Well, God had, you know, these commandments, and so he went to an Irishman and he said, I have some commandments for you. And the Irishman said, well, tell me one. He says, well, thou shalt not drink. The Irishman said, sorry about that. I like to drink. I just can't do that. So then went to a Frenchman and says, I got some commandments here. Frenchman said, well, tell me one. Thou shalt not commit adultery, fornication. The Frenchman said, yeah, I think maybe I better not take any of those commandments. So they went to a Jew, and the Jew said, I have some commandments for you. And the Jew said, how much do they cost? And God said, they're free. And the Jew said, I'll take 10.
Terrible ethnic joke. But I thought it was funny.
Okay. All of these commandments about relationship with people not only correlate with the relationship with God, but also emphasize the value of relationship over transaction. What he is doing is showing them there's a different way of living. It's a completely different way of living. And if it's a completely different way of living, trying to live it transactionally isn't going to work. I'm going to let you try it so that you know it, so that you feel it, so that you experience the fact that you cannot live in a relational kingdom transactionally. You can't bring that over, because the minute you do, you've just brought yourself back into that old kingdom.
Were they able to live in a relational kingdom before Christ?
No.
Okay.
Yes and no. We have a little bit of it with Moses, because he's able to go into his presence, mm-hmm. right? It took Moses 40 years to kind of get rid of, it's not about me. And in fact, we see Moses at the beginning of the Exodus so unsure about himself that it takes him a while to depend on God. But there's this learning curve. There are instances in the Old Testament that we see people living by the Spirit.
Mm-hmm. But the Spirit comes and goes.
So we do see that.
So little snippets.
So we do see little snippets. We see Abraham. He does walk with God. Knowing God is that. So we see these. What we don't see is a whole people. Mm-hmm. And he says, I'm calling you to be priests. He never says, I'm calling each one of you to be a priest. He says it as a group. Because he wants a body with all the parts, not just a head. And so what he's doing is, it isn't about, in fact, we'll kind of get to that. He is talking to people, not one person. He looks at groups as his body. So he began by speaking to a group being Adam and Eve. That was the first group he spoke to as one body. He makes them one, but they're really two people. And so it's this group. And he doesn't speak to a group of people again until this point. So it's showing that I'm going to show you little by little that you can live by the Spirit before Christ comes. But again, he said to Abraham, I'm preaching you the gospel. I'm preaching you about the seed, about Christ. You believe me. But it's not until a group of people come that he actually has a body. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But just to clarify in my own mind, we think we're living in relationships, or we have relationships,
mm-hmm.
but there's two ways.
Mm-hmm.
So there was always relationship, but either it was transactional or it's transformational. We're accustomed to transformation because it gets what we want.
Transaction.
Right. So it's all we've always had relationships.
Right.
You can still have a relationship with someone, but it's going to be either by transaction or by the Spirit.
Right.
And that's what's different.
Right, exactly. And we call it relationship, but in reality, transactional relationships are not really relationship.
I know, but that's what we call
it. But we call it that, yes. So that's what God is trying to say is, I've got a different way of living that actually values relationship instead of looking at relationship as a way to get what I want. Okay. So what are the purposes of each of these things that he's done? He's invited, he's shown them how to approach, and he has given them the living arrangements. The purpose of the invitation is to give them a free choice. He wants them to have a free choice to be his. Do you want to be mine? Yes, they say. Because the funny thing is, he delivered them without asking them whether they wanted to be delivered, right? And he protected them, and he brought them to this place all without asking. Now he's saying, okay, so I've done all this for you. I've shown you who I am. Do you want to be mine? And they actually say, yeah, we do. That sounds like a great thing. Yeah, we'd love to be your priests. He also gives them an opportunity to try to have what is good, what he's given them, by the way that they are accustomed to, by transactions. So do you assent to these conditions? So why does he give them that? Because he wants them to experience trying to get life by transactions, trying to get what is really good, relationship, by transactions. He wants them to experience it because they will not have a clue otherwise. And if we think that by telling someone, here's how you live, don't have any other gods before him, make no images, don't steal, this is how you live, and we think, well, as long as they have this list here, they know how to do it. No, they don't, because they can't do it, and they're going to try, but if they try to do it, they're going to find out, I actually can't do that. And either go, I need something else, or I'll just keep trying, or I just won't think that that's important. That doesn't really, and we'll have relationships fall apart all the time. We'll have life fall apart all the time, trying to get it done transactionally. So this is why he invites them this way. And we've talked about this over and over again. God always invites, which means if God always invites, instead of saying, you must do it this way, you must do it through my power, he doesn't say that. He invites. Well, try it your way and then see if you need me. If God always invites, then the way we relate to people is inviting, not by telling, not by demanding. the approach. We have this unapproachable mountain. Why does he do it that way? First of all, he demonstrates the magnitude of the invitation. You're getting invited to an intimate relationship with me, and look who I am. I am something you cannot pin down. I am not anything like the gods that you have had in Egypt. To demonstrate the magnitude of the invitation, this is a great big invitation for you. This is like you received an invitation from the President of the United States to have dinner rather than your neighbor. This is a huge invitation that you have to enter a relationship with him. Also to demonstrate, we've talked about already, his power, his otherness, of who you're coming into relationship with, what he's like. But also, and mainly, it was to protect them from trying to enter into a marriage relationship and dragging the lovers with them. How would it be if walking down the aisle, a bride was carrying a couple of her lovers with? It, first of all, would be a mockery of what's happening, right? And he's it would be awful. And God is saying, I don't want you to be consumed by me. I don't want you to be burned up because you have come making a mockery of me. You've come saying I'm not who I am. Because he cannot abide someone coming to his face and saying, you are not everything. You are not the one who provides all of life. Because that's what you do when you come to him with your lovers dragging along. So this way of showing them, there's going to be boundaries and there's going to be fire and don't come near. I don't want you to be consumed because I know you actually still have all your lovers. In fact, they're going to show up in the next couple chapters. We're going to just bring them outright. We're not even going to pretend we don't have them. I don't want you to be consumed. So he's making a boundary right now because he knows they can't get rid of those lovers even if they wanted to. They just are so attached to them and they have no way of severing. So what's the purpose of the living arrangement? It's a picture of what God values. It's a picture. I value this kind of relationship, a relationship that is based on love, that is based on grace, that we give one another respect and honor. This is what I have saved you for. This is not how I've saved you. This is not how I'm going to save you. I've already saved you. This is what I've saved you for. This kind of a life, this kind of a kingdom, a place where relationship is the value and grace is the base. Also to reveal the superiority of living in a relational kingdom rather than a transactional kingdom.
Relationship is the value, and the grace is the base. Okay. Thanks.
Thirdly, to reveal that people value transactions. I can say to you, you're transactional. And you can say, oh, no, I'm not. No, I love God. And then I say, well, okay, so just pick one command. What command would you like to see? Not murder? You don't murder? Okay, fine. Try not to murder. I'm going to try. See? You're going to try. And I hear. And what do we hear all the time from each other? I'm really trying to do this, right? Mm-hmm. And as soon as we say that, what is it? I'm a transaction. What God is looking for, what God is training us is, I'm resting. I'm stopping. I'm receiving what God has for me. What's the rhythm? Stop and receive, right? Sow and grow. Allow him to do the growing. Allow him to give you what you need. It's this trying that he's trying to show you. You're doing it all the time. You are transactional. And so he puts these out as, yes, this is what it's going to look like. Go ahead and try it because it doesn't work. And I'm going to show you you're going to try. I have to show you that you are transactional, that you value transactions, in fact, and you value them rather highly.
We become what we value.
Yes.
It'll come out.
Exactly. Exactly. So he has to give us this experience here of I'm going to reveal that you value transactions, and I'm going to little by little wean you off of those transactions.
So, Jill, like when we pray for something that's difficult and it's mm-hmm. in the way that's pleasing to me, or thank you, mm-hmm. you know, then how do you make it not be like a transaction, or I prayed for it and he gave it to me? You know, I don't want to think that way. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times it's like, whatever it is, just please help us to see what you're doing and deal with whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not to mention, we've almost made the gospel completely transactional, too, right? Mm-hmm. Not just our prayer request, but I do this prayer. You save me.
Right. Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Well, exactly. Yeah, so, exactly.
I mean, and I prayed, say, for my husband. And
right.
later
right.
that day, he's like, oh, you know, just my prayer was answered.
Mm-hmm.
He called me and said, this happened. And I'm like, oh, I prayed for you this morning. And I didn't want it to seem like because I prayed for you, God decided to do that. I was like, well, he's
right.
working stuff out. And it's,
right.
but then what do I take mm-hmm. from that?
He allowed you to see it.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like
yeah.
saying, okay, here you go.
Yep.
Here you can see what I've been doing.
Right.
But still, I feel like I'm still seeing it transactionally, even
mm-hmm.
though I'm trying not to.
Mm-hmm.
It has to do with your will, not my will.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, you say what you would like, but you let God make the decision.
Mm-hmm.
And so that I think that just confirms that your will was his will. Or his
oh,
will was your will. I mean,
yeah.
What you wanted uh-huh.
was in line with what he was doing.
Okay.
Doing.
Okay. Right, right.
He's still, when we continue,
yeah,
he's
still saying,
still
like, what
right.
are you doing? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Here's
yeah.
the thing. Here's with prayer, this is always the problem. We think the purpose of prayer is a transaction.
Mm-hmm.
What's the purpose of prayer?
Relationship.
Depending on you. God, it's in your hands. And every time we pray, it's an opportunity for us to connect with God. We're talking to God. We're relating to God. God, this is how I feel. I don't want Paul to get into an accident. I don't, you know, I love Paul. I want him to be saved. This is how I feel, God. This is a conversation with him. But if I enter it as a transaction, then I will always see the answer as a transactional. So the purpose of prayer is a huge thing. That's why there, you know, sometimes we have these cutesy little bumper stickers and things that just drive me nuts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, prayer accomplishes things, or I can't remember how they say it now. There was a big one when I was in high school. Ah, that's a transaction.
Yeah.
Prayer is about conversing with God.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about asking to get something. We will do that in our conversation, just like I'll do that with you. You know, Carol and I are talking today, and oh, Carol, would you do that for me? I'm not conversing with her so I get her to do something. I'm conversing because we're talking. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
It is, again, always these paradigm shifts for us of living within a kingdom that's relational rather than transactional. We are so transactional that it is difficult for us to pull ourselves away and rest and go, I just want to converse with God. And I'm going to tell him all the things I would want to see. Why I want, and this is why when I teach prayer in Philippians, it's so important because it actually says when you go to God, when you ask, you tell him why you want it. Because as soon as you do, you can disconnect going, oh, that's a transaction. I just want to talk with you. I want your will to be done because I know that's what's best. So I'm lots of things there. But does that kind of answer your question a little? Okay. So we have... the law, the covenant, the old covenant here is a picture of what God values, reveals the superiority of living in a relational as opposed to a transactional, revealing that we do value transactions. That's why he says, I give you these in order to test you. I'm showing you, I'm bringing out to you what is hard, you know, what's a stress test all about? I'm showing you where your weaknesses are. That's what I'm showing you here. Ultimately, this covenant here is to bring us to the point of abandoning the old transactional life, myself as God, being controlled by my own desires. It's ultimately to come to the end of myself so that I'm ready and empty to receive the gift that he has. He says, I'm actually going to do this for you. I'm going to do all these for you. I'm going to make relationships like this for you. But I can't get there ready to receive it unless I've said, I cannot do it. I cannot. It's to bring us to the point of, I got to give up these transactions. I can't do it anymore. Does that make sense? This is why the New Testament calls the Old Covenant a tutor. It's training us that we need him. It's training us that even though this is what the kingdom looks like, it's not us that accomplishes it. It's him. It's training us to realize this is what I want, but I can't do it. I cannot separate myself from God. So all of that is in a nutshell kind of what 19 and 20 are. But that's just the first layer. And if there's more layers, what do the other layers look like? And this is where I start getting really excited. And we could go forever here. So believe me, I know that there are thousands of passages we can go into. But what's the second layer? Well, the fact is that this has all happened before. When did he speak to a group of people before? With Adam and Eve. And it's the last time he did so. He hasn't spoken to a group of people since. He's spoken to individuals, but never to a group. And he spoke to them in the garden, in Genesis 2 and 3. He lives with them. He walks with them. God speaks from a place of fire. That's what we're seeing here. This has happened before. First of all, we know with Moses it's happened before, right? Where did God speak out of a fire with Moses? In the burning bush. Where was the burning bush?
On
Mount Sinai. This very same place. Remember what he said to Moses when he spoke? You will know that it is I who have delivered you, because I will bring you and all the people back to this very place. Here they are at Mount Sinai. And he's speaking from a burning bush. And Acts tells us, actually, he gives us more description about the bush. The bush is actually a thorny bush. What does Mount Sinai mean? Thorny. He's speaking out of a thorny wilderness mountain here to Moses and to the people. But has he ever done it before? What is God doing? What have we always talked about God doing? God's desire is to have intimate relationship with us. It's how he started out with Adam and Eve, right? And when they lost it, God said, I'm not giving up. I will refresh Eden. I will redo this again because I want intimate relationship with you. If that's the case, that all parts of his story have to go back, that we've lost it and he's trying to refresh it. Mm-hmm. So that the Mount Sinai thing, this marriage proposal, he's trying to refresh the intimate relationship he had. So that means that all these things had to have a beginning. Did God speak from the fire in Genesis? If you haven't looked at your notes, does anybody know? Was there fire in Eden ever?
Well, the flaming swords.
The flaming swords. And what were the flaming swords' purpose? A barrier from his presence. Because they chose. I no longer want to be under you. I want to have distance. And so we have at the very beginning God speaking from fire to say, you've chosen a barrier. You've chosen to be distant from me. And so we have this, and the fact that Genesis 3, 23 and 24.
Okay, no fire until the fall, basically.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
The Lord God sent him out of the Garden of Eden to cultivate the ground from which he was taken. So he drove the man, and at the east of the Garden of Eden, he stationed the cherubim and the flaming sword, which turned every direction. To what do? To guard the way to the tree of life. Okay, you should start, I'm not going to tell you all of them, because you should start going, tree of life, tree of life, tree of life. Have the Israelites seen in any form a tree of life?
Yeah.
What did it do? It turned the waters sweet. Tree of life, keep thinking. Everything that happened in Eden is going to be reversed. And God is all about refreshing, reversing, reinventing what he started with. And so we begin to see that this Mount Sinai is all about beginning that reversal process. So we see that with Moses. He starts it with Moses. Ooh, fire in a bush. God speaking from fire. This is important, God speaking from fire. And now is God speaking from fire again for the third time that we see. And there will be several other ones, but we see this. So we know that Moses is at the exact same place. He's at Mount Sinai. He's also called Mount Horeb, and Horeb means desolate. So wilderness, we're talking about thorny wilderness. Where were Adam and Eve taken from the garden when they left? To where? Where are they taken out to? To basically a wilderness. And what does he call that? In fact, I hope I'm not getting ahead of myself, but he says the curse when after the fall, the curse is, I will now make you go to the ground where you have to till it, and it will be all thorny. And so we have these pictures of a thorny ground and fire. We have a thorny mountain in the wilderness with fire. God is literally using devices to show us, I'm renewing everything. I'm renewing it. I'm renewing it. I'm bringing it back. I haven't forgotten. It's what I am doing all the time. So when we say God is always working covenant, he's always renewing Eden.
So what is this? What,
the thorns? The thorns. It's a picture. It's a picture of what is death away from his presence.
Pain.
And it's pain. We're going to see it again, and then I think you'll understand.
So, okay. So essentially when Jesus felt that separation from God with the thorn on his head.
Right, right. Okay. So, and God with people. So we've already seen that Adam and Eve are in the garden, but they're removed from his intimate presence. Moses from the burning bush until now. God is with the Israelites only by default, because he's actually with Moses. And so by default, because he and Moses are leading them, the Israelites get to be in on this. So we've gone from a garden with intimate fellowship of the divine and human. This marriage that he already was talking about with them in Sinai, it already happened. There was this intimate relationship where God walked with man in a garden. We've gone from that, Adam, Eve, taken out of that to a place, a thorny wilderness, a place away from the garden and away from his presence, separated by God's fire. Now, that's the second layer. This has already happened. So we're in, this is happening now in Mount Sinai. Oh, this should, to the people, this has happened before. What's God doing here? This is why he says, stop. Stop. You've got to see what's going on here. I'm renewing what I originally intended. And so he has them stop, and he wants them to begin to see. What's the third layer? That this is going to happen again. And remember, we're sitting at Mount Sinai. So it's going to happen again. God will speak to a group of people as intimates again after this. Where does he speak to them as intimates? And this is where we could get into just basically, you know, put the whole New Testament down on here. Jesus speaks to his disciples as intimates and to those who believe. He says, I love this verse, you are my friends. Where we heard from, every time you see a word, you go, where have we heard it the first time? Where have I heard friends the first time? With Abraham. Okay, you are my friends. If you do what I command, no longer do I call you slaves. I don't call you slaves anymore. Oh, slaves. What does that? Every time we see in Scripture certain words, we go, wait, where have I heard that before? Where's the first time I heard that before? Okay, so what you're seeing is, here's Eden, here's Mount Sinai, here's Christ. Here's these three points where we stop and go, God is refreshing. God is doing this. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you. This is exactly what he says to Israel. These are the same things. I'm choosing you. I'm doing it. It's grace. In order that you should go and bear fruit, to love one another and bear witness of me. What is he asking Israel? You want to do? You want to be my priests? You want to be the ones who bear my image? And this is what he tells, of course, the believers in John. So, God speaks from a place of fire. Now, this is where like go get huge, and I'm gonna eliminate a million of them. I'm just gonna give you, just hone in on some, and there's lots and lots and lots. And when I talk about a place of fire, it's that whole picture that we saw, the thunder, the lightning, the dark clouds, the earthquake, everything. So here we go. Let's see if we can get some of it in. Hebrews 12 is the key that just says it's connected. This is not like, oh, I saw this, I'm going to make up this literary device. It's connected. Hebrews tells us, for you have not come to a mountain that can be touched. And, you know, did we have this in our homework, this Hebrew passage? No, we didn't. And she may do it next week. But you have come to Mount Zion. You're not at Mount Sinai anymore. You're at Mount Zion. And Zion actually means a guiding sign, as in a wilderness. And to the city of the living God. And to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant. Moses is the mediator of the old covenant. The one who can come into God's presence for them. But you've not come to Moses anymore. You've come to Jesus here. Therefore, since we receive a kingdom that cannot be shaken, see, he's talking about a new kind of kingdom, a kingdom that doesn't change. Let us show gratitude by which we may offer to God an acceptable service with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. He does still consume anything that isn't relationally good and holy in this kingdom. John 19, Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns. Okay, so we're back at a mountain, a thorny mountain. Mount Zion being this place of wilderness, but as a sign, it says. That's what the Zion means. And he's wearing this thorn, this, I'm taking on the thorny wilderness for you. I'm taking it on, and I'm going to destroy it. Matthew 27, darkness fell upon all the land. This is when he dies. The veil of the temple was torn. And this is where I started going, oh my gosh, this gets so exciting. The veil. Well, if you've never actually made a temple or tabernacle, you don't know what the veil looks like. But the veil actually has cherubim on them. And you go, whoa, he tore the veil. Not only is it flesh, but it's the fire barrier between God and man. And the veil gets torn here. So we see this fire barrier being torn up. And the earth shook, and the rocks were split, and the tombs were opened, and saints were raised. So much in there. John 19:41. So we have Christ taking the thorny mountain, and he kills the thorny mountain, and he just makes everything happen again. And this picture of, wow, it's happening again. God is doing something here. And it says, in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden, a new tomb. Where are we back to? Eden. We've gone from the garden to the thorny wilderness, from the thorny wilderness back to the garden. Matthew 27, and they gave orders for the grave to be made secure until the third day, because he had said, on the third day, I will raise up. Wait for the third day. Matthew 28, a severe earthquake had occurred, for an angel of the Lord descended from heaven and came and rolled away the stone. Why did I underline that? Because one of the key words here, the key phrases are, God comes down, Moses comes up. Moses goes down, Moses goes up. It's God coming down to earth, and every time we have a picture of God coming down to earth, it is to deliver and judge. Deliver first, then judge. Deliver first, then judge. And rolled away the stone, and his appearance was like lightning. It's not a coincidence that he allows all the authors to use these words, because they will conjure up for all the people, if they know his words, if they've listened to his words, the picture of what he's doing. Matthew 28, then Jesus said to them, do not be afraid. Wait, we've come not to the mountain that shakes and quakes, but we've come to Mount Zion, where Christ has taken the thorny wilderness and defeated it. And we've come to a garden. And so now Jesus can say, don't be afraid. There's all of this fear God, fear God, fear God. But when we come through the training, there comes a point where it's do not be afraid. I am with you. close, not at a distance. So we have this whole refreshing of don't be afraid. In fact, in the garden, what happens with they're in intimate connection with them, they're walking with him, they're in his presence, and when they sin, what do? They hide. Why? Because they say they're afraid. That's the first afraid, and Jesus is erasing
Moses
it all.
Moses said that too, though.
Moses did. Moses is still, that's right. Moses says, don't be afraid, but then he says, but be afraid. For a time, that you're going to be afraid. Just like when I tell my toddler, don't touch the stove is dangerous. But when she gets to be 22 years old, I don't say that, right? You no longer need to fear the stove because you've learned the power of the stove. And you respect the power of the stove, and now you may let it give you life. So it's going to change, Christ says. The refreshing is we're going back to how Eden is. This is what Christ is doing. Matthew 28:16. But the 11 disciples proceeded to Galilee, where? To the mountain which Jesus had designated, and when they saw him, they worshipped him. And we have everything to correspond with what's going on. They were told to consecrate and wash. They were told to do that. Who washes in the scenario with Christ?
He does.
He does. He washes our feet. So all of these things, I mean, we could go on for decades to see all of the beautiful ways he shows us. Luke 24, all things which are written about me in the law of Moses. Does the law of Moses ever say, well, Jesus will die on a cross and raise? No. He shows what Jesus is like. This is what Jesus is like. This Ten Commandments here, this law here, that's what Jesus looks like. That relation, that's what he looks like. And Jesus says, that was about me. It must be fulfilled. The Christ should suffer and rise again from the dead the third day. And repentance for forgiveness of sins be proclaimed in his name to all nations, beginning from Jerusalem, from this mountain where I took the thorny wilderness and killed it. And now proclaim, we're going back to Eden. I'm reversing it all. That's how he has spoken from the fire now in Christ's day. And that's what they're going to look forward to. And they should know at this point, God is refreshing things. And he's already told Abraham he's going to do it in a seed. God with people. Where are we going to see it again? With his disciples. I'm with you always. About all who believe. And this passage is phenomenal when we think about it. For those also who believe in me through their word, that they may all be one. That all believers will be one. And what is he calling them to be? In a relationship where two are as one. That's what he was calling in Sinai. It's what he's calling now. Even as thou, Father, art in me and I in thee, that they also may be in us, that the world may believe that thou didst send me. And the glory which thou hast given me, I have given them, that they may be one, just as we are one. I in them, and thou in me, that they may be perfected in unity. That the world may know that you sent me and loved me even as you did love me. Love them. They are a body, he's saying. As a whole, they're the body that God has been looking for. And they are a body that God has been looking for because of one thing. And that's the next thing. And I couldn't decide whether to put this under God will speak from a place of fire or God will be with people, because it belongs in both. Acts 2. And when the day of Pentecost had come, and this is why we did the specific, how long have they been away from Passover? 50 days. Pentecost is the 50th day after Passover. In the Old Testament, we called it the Feast of Weeks, or the Feast of First Fruits. We call it in the New Testament Pentecost. So Pentecost, they know, is 50 days after Passover. And what happened 50 days after Passover for the Jews? They met God at Mount Sinai for a proposal of a relationship. And now what's happening on Pentecost, on this very day, very, very day, They were all together in one place, just like Israel camping out all together in one place. And suddenly there came from heaven a noise like a violent rushing wind. Man, this should start, we're back at Mount Sinai. And there appeared to them tongues as of fire. And the fire was distributing themselves. The tongues of fire were distributing. All of a sudden, this veil of fire is by itself. We're going to be individually on each these people. And they rested on each of them. And they were filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak with other tongues. And we hear them in our own tongues speaking the mighty deeds of God. No longer is the fire a barrier. It is now and only an identification of God's presence here. God's presence here. God's presence here. And what happens when God's presence is here? God gets displayed for who he is. They speak. And how they speak is not in unknown tongues. It is in tongues that everyone can hear their own. They spoke in Aramaic. They spoke in Greek. They spoke in this. Everybody's hearing their own language, what God has done, all the marvelous deeds God has done, because of God's presence in them. And it's resting there. And so we've gone from a thorny wilderness mountain in Sinai to life in a garden again. Intimate relation of divine and human has actually been realized here at Pentecost. So that marriage proposal back there is now coming to fruition. Does that excite you?
Yes.
Does that like...
And the last paradigm is the marriage of the bride and the
groom. Yes, exactly. And that's why there's not just three layers, but there's four layers. Mm-hmm. And of course, I did think, all right, do I even think about going into Revelation? Because, guys, yeah. Revelation is the culmination of it all. Yeah. And we see the fire back. Mm-hmm. And we see the tree of life back, and we begin to see all of these pictures and go, wow, he really is doing that.
You should send us the fourth layer.
We'll do the fourth layer at some other time. So, what does this story have to do with us? First and foremost, it should excite us to the core. Because what it says is, God, right now, this very day, is renewing Eden. Not just in my life, but in all the world. So that when we see the things happening and we tear our hair and we think, these are so awful, the world's going just terrible. Do we see the third layer? That's the second layer. Do we see the third? Do we see that God is still renewing Eden here? And in order to renew Eden, he is going to have to bring people to abandon themselves.
By way of fire.
So absolutely.
Instead of being afraid of the fire.
Yes.
And don't pray away the fire.
Right. Right.
Let the fire right. do its work.
Right. And be excited that God is renewing Eden in me, in you, in your family, and wherever. He's renewing it. Now, as he's renewing it, he gives them a choice. Do you want to come in or not? Do you want to be a part of this or not? They get to choose. But that is what he's doing. So, knowing, first of all, that we can approach the throne of God in Christ, whereas they couldn't do that. We can do it with boldness rather than fear. And I think she might next week go into Hebrews, so I'm careful not to. But of course, Hebrews is basically the whole picture of what God has been doing. That we get to receive mercy and grace constantly, every day. And we can actually be counted as faithful in a relationship because we don't try to do it transactionally. I am not counted as faithful when I obey the Ten Commandments transactionally. Does that make sense? That's not being faithful. That's being idolatrous and adulterous when I'm trying to do the Ten Commandments transactionally, when I'm trying to do them. Does that make sense? Secondly, we can live in constant gratitude, which is what Hebrews talks about. So now that we know all this, now that we know we haven't come to the same mountains in Sinai, we've come to Mount Zion, we can be grateful. We can offer ourselves to God as our Lord, as the I Am. He's here. He's renewing me. And I can rest. What gratitude. I don't have to strive. I can gladly allow his desires to control me. because I understand what he's doing. I know what he's doing. I see that eagle of the thorns and making me fight that flesh, letting it get torn so that I depend on him, which is my acceptable service of reverence and awe, which is the whole point of this, is revere God for what he's doing. Not just that he's powerful, but that he's renewing Eden with that power. That's what he's doing. The Ten Commandments are no longer a tutor for me, a list to try to live up to, but they're a reminder for me of what God is doing in me. This is what God is doing in me. He's training me to have no other gods. He is, bit by bit, in grace and mercy by his patience, he is little by little bringing me to battles with my flesh so I won't have any other gods. That is what he's doing in me. And I can say no, or I can let him.
I feel like it's a like a red flag. You know, like, yes, when I'm coveting or I'm murdering, then I am going back to number one.
Right.
I am not letting God
right.
be my all
right.
in all. I'm
right.
not
right.
abiding,
right.
you know, rather
right.
than just working
right.
on that.
Right.
I'll try not to covet anymore.
Right.
It's like,
right.
go back to the top.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then
yep.
it draws you to the one who did.
Exactly.
It all.
Exactly.
Oh, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's drawing you back to
yep. Yep. So you see, this different paradigm of looking at the Ten Commandments is actually very encouraging. It is not a list of, oh, today I gotta really be hard. I'm not going to steal today. I'm going to really not steal somebody's reputation. I'm going to try hard. No, that's a transaction. This is what God is doing in me. Oh, so now I understand why I'm having a hard time going through this part, because God is trying to have me fight my flesh, get rid of that idol in me. That makes sense?
Well, the word that comes up for me, like, is indicators.
Indicators, good. That's,
you know?
That's a good, yes.
And then,
yep.
like, even when the part that says, you are my friends if you do what I command, again, it's like what you were talking about before. It looks like a transaction
yes.
when you first hear it.
Yes,
mm-hmm. but,
right.
But then if you know, then you go, okay, it's an indicator.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
right.
Like, my doing what he's commanding is an indicator of our friendship.
Right,
mm-hmm.
exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly. And what he's actually doing in me. So it can come be exciting when we go, wow, I'm battling here. That's cool, because God is actually making this work out for me. So when we look at battles, we all of a sudden we go, wow, God actually is renewing. He's going, yep, I'm getting rid of this so that you get back to Eden. That's exciting. That should be. So we should look at these as, huh, that's so cool. It gives me an idea of what God is doing in me, which I think is what my next one is. A reminder that how he's doing that in, oh, that what God is doing in me, and a reminder that how he's doing it in me by bringing me to these battles is grace, that it's good. This is grace, that he's bringing me to a point of abandoning myself. I just give up. I am at the end of myself. These are words that
rest.
We use
Sit
so that
rest.
I can rest.
You
exactly,
know?
Exactly. So these are reminders that it's grace. These little wars are grace so I can rest. And a reminder that this is what he has actually made me for. This is what he's made me for, to have a relationship with him and with others. Which means if that's what he's doing in me, he's also doing it in others. And so if you know that, if we come together and go, wow, God is dealing with me here because he's bringing me to Eden, he's also doing that in you. And so all of a sudden we have a lot more grace for each other, right? Because when I'm ignoring the fact that God is helping me go through battle fleshes, or fleshes of battles of my flesh, when I'm ignoring that, then I'm transactionally and I come to you not in grace. But if I'm battling and I'm letting God bring me to those places, then I come with grace with you going, I know that God's bringing you to those places too. So, man, you know, now we're in it together. Looks different. So here's the objects in the mirror are much larger than they appear. What's going on is God is renewing Eden. The battles are a much bigger idea here. The battles are to get rid of what is the wilderness, the thorny wilderness. The battle are places where God is bringing you, renewing you, and renewing your mind, but also renewing the place you live. He's renewing in you the kingdom of God. And so when the Gospels talk about the kingdom of God is within you, he is trying to show you there's all this stuff that needs to get out so that you can actually experience the kingdom that is within you. So don't miss the greater story. Let him give you the eyes to see. Let him stop you at Sinai so that you understand what he's doing. And maybe it's going to take a year like it took them to stay at Sinai. Because he's going to give them more pictures and more pictures. Because this is where they're going to build the tabernacle. So we see him doing a great work. And it talks about that in the prophets toward the end of the Old Testament. He'll say, I'm doing a marvelous work. And we all stop at that. Or, I have great plans for you. I know I have plans for your future and hope, right? And everybody stops at the end of that verse. But what's the verse after that? Anybody know? You will seek me and you'll find me if you call me. And then it goes, and this is how I'm going to do it. I'm going to bring you through some really tough times. And no one ever puts that on the end of that. And God says, and this is all to restore you to me and to Eden. So we are way over time. I told you we would keep going. Father, thank you. Thank you, thank you that you will not give up refreshing Eden in us. Lord, I pray for eyes to see. I pray that we would rest, that we would stop at Sinai so that we might see that you're refreshing Eden, not only in us, but in our families and in the people that you bring to us and in the world. Father, may we have eyes to see you working, and might we rest, allowing you to work. Might we receive that gift of you restoring Eden by allowing you to bring us to the places of war against our flesh, by bringing us to the places of being in your rhythm rather than our own. You are so good to us. In Jesus' name, amen.
I already got a question.